Welcome to episode 39 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Nancy Cohen, a New Jersey artist who was introduced to handmade paper during a residency program at Dudonné Paper Mill in New York City in the early 1990s. She became entranced with paper as a material, and she tells me about the similarities she finds between paper and glass, another material she works intimately with. Nancy creates all of her work without her own papermaking studio. She brings wet sheets that she forms at Dudonné back to her studio, and she is pushing the medium in really interesting ways. We discuss the life cycle of her installations, which she often exhibits multiple times, her pulp drawings that were recently on view in New York City, and how she helped her son and daughter-in-law create their handmade paper wedding invitations, guerrilla style. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Nancy Cohen, welcome to Paper Talk. I remember meeting you, 25 plus years ago at Dudonné Paper Mill when you were a resident in the Workspace Residency Program. Was that 1993, I think?
Correct, 1993.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how you got interested in paper and how your journey brought you to Dudonné.
Actually, Dudonné was my first contact with handmade paper. Mm-hmm. I had worked in ceramics as an undergraduate, had worked mostly with porcelain, was interested in translucency and transparency. And it was really a friend who had already worked at Dudonné, an artist that I met when I lived in China named Wan Yi, mm-hmm. who had the residency first and told me about it.
Oh, cool. Okay, so let's backtrack a little bit. So did you go to art school and study ceramics?
Yeah, I went to the School for American Craftsmen at Rochester Institute of Technology. So it was more of a craft program than it was art school, but and it was very Bauhaus designed in its format. So it was intensely ceramics. And then by the time I was done at RIT, I was making sculpture, combining clay with other materials, and then stopped using clay entirely. And after a year, went to grad school for sculpture.
Okay, is that program still there at RIT?
I'm not sure about that. Okay. I know that there was a question. It was, there were five departments, and I think one had been closed, and I had heard talk that they might be closing the whole school, but I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, tell me a little bit about translucency and what that means to you or what draws you to that.
Well, I don't really know.
Okay.
But I've always been interested in light, and when I was working with clay, I loved the malleability of the material, and then porcelain kind of allowed light to come through it. And I have always been interested in working with materials where kind of the color, and I guess the light is in the material. So when I was working in clay, the porcelain sort of suited me more than other kinds of clay because there was kind of light and color in the material. In a sense, I didn't need to necessarily glaze it or glaze it with color. So when I started working in handmade paper, it sort of had, I was working with abaca, and it had sort of all of the qualities that I loved about clay, but none of the ones that I didn't like. Like it wasn't heavy and it wasn't fragile, but it was, it could work kind of like a slab of clay, and it would work like slip, and you could use it in all the ways that I was comfortable working, mm-hmm. I think is why I took to it so quickly. But then it introduced all kinds of new things, including an easier way to have the color in the material, although actually for years I didn't use color. I just was in love with the abaca as it was as a material.
Right. So what were the early pieces you made during the Workspace program? What were you exploring?
I worked with Paul, uh-huh. and it was very... You know, it was really new to me.
Right.
Very experimental. I was doing some work that had kind of pod-like forms. And I remember doing both, bringing in some wire armatures that I cast into, I guess it was sheets of cotton in that case, mm-hmm. so that they were almost like a relief sculpture, a flat base with a three-dimensional front. Mm-hmm. And some other forms where I was creating a skin over the wire armature. So I was working over a wire armature the whole time, some pressing them into flat sheets and some over an armature. I can't even totally remember because I've worked so much with clay since, but I have a couple of those pieces. And I remember it was a very funky space at that point, and so they had to dry the work on the roof. There wasn't even space to dry the pieces inside the studio.
Wow. So they were fairly large.
Well, they weren't that large, but they were large for what was going on.
And they couldn't be hung from the ceiling.
I don't know if that ever came up.
That's what I would have thought. Okay. So let's describe the Workspace Residency Program, actually. It's still going on. I think it's just available for New York State artists. And often the artists that do this program at Dudonné do not have experience with paper. So it really pushes the medium to new levels.
I think also from, you know, my experience, it also just introduces something entirely new, and watching other people that have done the residencies, you know, people are just like completely taken with it and continue to use it as part of their work for years to come, which is what happened with me. So it was at that time, it was 5 days, but not consecutively. Right. So you kind of came in first, Paul gave you an overview of what might be possible. He commented, he had some ideas looking at what you did, what you might do. And then it was sort of one day at a time. So the work had time to dry and you had time to think about it and look at it afterward. But it really, I remember it really feeling like I just got started. Like the 5 days was too small, too short.
Right.
I felt like I was just introduced to something and really was, you know, excited and desperate to have the chance to do something else. And there was a written post-residency interview, I guess, that you did. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying that I really wanted to do something more. And that Mina Takahashi, who was the director at the time, responded to that. And then we had a long conversation and followed it up with kind of proposing, kind of thinking of other ways that I could continue to work with Dudonné, that they could afford to have me work there and I could afford to work there because it was too expensive otherwise. And we ended up getting a grant together to do a project at the Staten Island Botanical Gardens that was funded by the Greenwald Foundation. So it was really that project from then that I like really became incredibly comfortable with the material, and that sort of set me going for the next 25 years.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that project, because I remember I still lived in New York then and I remember visiting it. It was up at the garden for several
maybe
months or a year.
Yeah, almost a year. So I had been very interested in gardens and interested in the idea of kind of what grew wild and what grew through, you know, gardeners. You know, like what was wild
cultivated.
Cultivated, that's the word. And my first idea was to try and do something at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. And Mina and I went to see, you know, the director there, who said basically, you know, she would be fired if she let me, you know, put sculpture in the greenhouse. So we sort of backed out from there and then approached Snug Harbor, which had a wonderful greenhouse. And one of the interesting things about it is it had two spaces. The first one was a public space, which had a formal garden, and then it connected to a room they called the propagation room, which was where they grew everything that was later planted, where they grew things that were later planted. So that perfectly suited my interest between the kind of interior and exterior, the formal and the more creative or germinating. So I ended up making a piece there. One large suspended form, very large, that hung over a pond of water lilies in the formal garden, and with kind of a ring of forms above it. And then in the propagation room, probably 30 pieces that were much smaller in scale that used gardening implements as the armatures. Mm-hmm. Actually, for the formal garden, I used vines that were from the gardens, branches and vines, as well as steel to support it. And then for the propagation room, all kinds of gardening implements. And we tested paper that would hold up to being watered, because anything in the greenhouse was both going to be rained on and watered over the time it was there. So you know, we were also looking for something that would kind of be able to get wet and hold its three-dimensional form. So I made some shapes and hung them there for probably 4 or 5 months before the actual project.
And these were abaca, and did you wax them?
We tested a bunch of materials, and both mm-hmm. abaca and linen worked, but the linen was much more expensive to use. So yeah, mm-hmm. it was abaca, and exactly, I painted hot wax on them and then took the wax off. We tried a few different experiments, but that worked the best. And so I didn't make the pieces at Tudene. I made the paper there, and that was sort of how I started this process that I use of making paper there and bringing it back wet to my studio and using it.
Yeah. I want to talk about that. But first I want to just say that during the time that those pieces were at the garden, the plants started growing around your pieces.
Yeah,
right?
It was amazing, right? So the propagation room, also I used kind of old garden hoses to hook up visually the spaces between the forms. And then ivy and plants started like sprouting all over the hoses and connecting the forms. So what felt like a fairly sparse thing in the beginning, 6 or 8 months later, was this wild thing where there were plants growing all over the sculptural elements. It was great. It was really crazy. And that was the only time that they let the public into that room, which had been closed to them before. So that was pretty exciting too.
Yeah. And then how did you deinstall?
We threw everything away.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I mean, it was able to, because they were, you know, it was enormous. And also, it had held up really well, but it had taken a little wear and tear. I saved a few of the elements from the smaller space, but the really large piece, which had some horizontal surfaces, so those caught the water more. Mm-hmm. It was fine. It looked fine. It probably could have stayed for years, but probably you didn't want to save it.
Right. I want to mention two little things that come to mind about this project, and I think these carry through your work. One is persistence. You mentioned that the Brooklyn Botanic Garden said no way, but you guys just turned to a different garden. You wanted to do this project, so that's cool. And the other is having an ally. So Mina at Dudonné was your ally and someone to brainstorm with and sort of keep you moving forward. I think those are cool.
Yeah, Mina has been amazing for me.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned making sheets and then bringing them back to your studio. I want to hear about that because it's a little unusual. The scope of your work, you've done so much with handmade paper, but you don't actually have your own papermaking studio.
Right. So with that first project, it would have just been too expensive for Dudonné for me to make the work there. You know, they need to use the studio for other things.
Right.
So I guess we experimented a little bit. We pressed the water out so that it was still damp, but not, you know, really wet. And I rolled the sheets of paper in plastic. And mm-hmm. I found that I can keep it in the refrigerator for like a year. And my experience is that if the paper dries, it's never the same if you use it again.
Right.
But if it stays wet, it doesn't have to be used that day. So
let me ask you just, so you're rolling multiple sheets onto a tube.
One sheet at a time. Yeah. So I'll take a sheet of paper. I'll pull it off of the Pellon. I'll put it on a plastic garbage bag and then I'll put another plastic garbage bag. So it's okay. Basically. And then I have a refrigerator in my studio just full of paper. So, right. So I have, you know, some small molds and I, you know, if I want to use a color or make something, you know, kind of 8.5 by 11, I can do that in my studio just mm-hmm. with my sink and, you know, very rudimentary, but I don't have a press or anything, but I continue to work at Dudonné in that method of making sheets and then, you know, bringing them back.
Right. And tell me about are you doing it actually in Dudonné or in their key holder space?
No, I mean, I actually haven't done anything in a while, but I haven't worked in the key holder space. There's been different things over the years. And some of the things I sort of, because I had a need, helped to develop. But what I've done in recent years is if there's four artists that want to share the studio together and they're all people that have worked at Dudenay before, generally other former workspace artists, mm-hmm. we can rent the studio together. We don't need a collaborator. We right. just need, you know, someone to set it up and an occasional like help.
Right.
But not too much. And then we also participate in the setup and cleanup and, you know, so it's, you know, a little bit of a different situation than if you're coming in and, you know, working with a collaborator. So it's worked great. I've done, you know, work there in different ways over the years. I've done a lot of projects at Dudenay and with different ways of working it out.
Right. That's cool how you have figured that out. And I know you work with glass as well. And I just wanted to briefly mention that because it's translucent and both materials are fluid at one state and then harden.
Right. They're very similar in that way, in that they change through the process of making. Mm-hmm. And they also share the ability to, they're translucent, they're transparent, they can be opaque, they have different kinds of textures, and they have the, they change in the process of making, like you said, and then the color is in the material. You know, you can color the material and then it has that rather than applied color. So that's also been interesting. And it's funny with the glass because it has all the problems that ceramics had, like the heaviness and the fragility.
Right.
But at this point, it isn't so much of an issue for me. And I love working with the two materials in combination. I've made a ton of sculpture that uses both glass and paper, and I feel like they're really nice together.
Yeah. So your studio is in Jersey City. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Queens, and I grew up in Queens and in New Rochelle.
Okay.
So I ended up in Jersey City, and I've, you know, lived some other places, but ended up in Jersey City, in New Jersey, mm-hmm. in the mid-80s. And sort of came to Jersey City in the late 80s because it was kind of convenient for my husband and I because we were commuting in two different directions and it mm-hmm. was very inexpensive at that moment. So it was a lucky time to land there.
Right, cool. And you have a separate studio. Have you always had a separate studio from your house?
I've pretty much always. I mean, there was a short time where I worked in kind of an attic of a house we rented, but mm-hmm. I'm very, very messy. Mm-hmm. in my studio. And it would be really hard for me to kind of not destroy the house if I worked at home, basically. When I had the studio where we lived, you know, I also work in other materials. So there was like cement in the kitchen sink and on the phone, you know, it was not good. So it's better for me to have, a physical and a psychological separation.
Right. And you, tell me about your studio practice, your sort of how you work in the studio time-wise, because I know you teach as well.
Right. I work pretty much as I can mm-hmm. other than, you know, teaching and then, you know, looking at art, seeing friends, family obligations, whatever. But I work in the studio, you know, at least several days a week, depending on my teaching schedule, 3 or 4 days a week. And, you know, pretty much I get up early and I pretty much work all the time. I know some people uh-huh. work for projects. I kind of work all of the time. And some of the time I'm working for a show or project, but I'm always working. I'm not really a happy person unless I'm working. So that's
right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I go back and forth between, you know, large scale installation, small sculpture, and the last few years I've spent a lot of my time on two-dimensional work that came out of an installation in handmade paper. And it's kind of, after all these years of using paper sculpturally, it's really interesting for me to be using it in a flatter format for the first time, but incredibly exciting too.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I wanted to let you know about a new program over here at Helen Hebert Studio. I've started a free Facebook group called Club Paper. It's a place to share what you're working on, get encouragement when you need a little push, Be inspired with new ideas, tips, tricks, books, and supplies, all having to do with paper. I hope to create a place over there where we feel like we're in a clubhouse, working on projects and having a conversation together. We're building a paper community, one sheet at a time. Join us by going to Facebook and searching for the group Club Paper. Now back to the episode.
Okay, so let's talk about your work and let's maybe start with that installation.
Okay, so I've been interested for a long time in water and pieces and waterways, both as a sort of visual inspiration, kind of going back from my childhood, and also kind of the environmental issues surrounding our waterways and the kind of idea of the fragility and the resilience of our waterways and the plants that use them and the animals and, you know, all the complicated, interesting issues around water and around water in the industrial area that I live in of Jersey City. So I'm right on the Hudson. I'm really close to the Hackensack. I'm not far from the Passaic or Newark Bay. So there's a lot of stuff to think about and see. So I became interested in the Hackensack River and stumbled with a friend on a really interesting marsh on a sort of sunny winter day where all of these tree stumps were frozen and seemed to be submerged in ice. Anyway, I got very taken with a particular spot and kept visiting it over the course of a year and trying to learn more about it and started trying to evoke just elements of the marsh, but then eventually trying to kind of almost recreate the marsh in my studio and was doing that in paper and in glass largely, but also making armatures out of wire, covering them with paper, using rubber as well, and then doing some kind of large scale drawings on the wall that extended to the floor that were made out of paper. So I was trying to create an environment that evoked that environment. And then what happened that was really transformative, I mean, that piece I was really close to and worked on for a really long time and did some things that I'd never done before with paper. Like one thing was I had all of these elements all over the floor, some glass elements, some paper elements, and they felt very disparate. And then I kept trying to figure out how to connect them. And at one point I just thought, I remembered what it looked like at Dudenay when all that pulp is like all over the floor at the end of the day. And I thought, what if I just pour the pulp right on the floor? And I had a cement floor in my studio. So I just like took the pulp and poured it on the floor and started like mushing around with it and ended up creating kind of an environment for all the elements to live in that was like a pulp painting, but directly on the ground. So anyway, so that was a fun, exciting thing.
Yeah.
But the first time that the piece got shown, the installation, it had a wall that my studio at that point had two very long walls in it and a glass at the back end of windows. Mm-hmm. And so the gallery space didn't have those windows. It had one more wall and it was about 10 feet tall and 8 feet wide. And when I was going to show the installation at that gallery, which is where you saw it, Helen,
all
of a sudden there was like another wall. And I was like, oh no, it's going to ruin the whole thing if it doesn't feel like you're in one space. And I didn't really want to keep, continuing the elements. So I ended up making, without really thinking too much about it, one giant drawing that filled the whole wall that was a 10-foot tall drawing that was about the experience of getting to this marsh. And I pieced together wet pieces of handmade paper, almost like they were a quilt to make the backing. And then I used more sheets of wet paper and pulp to draw on it.
Mm-hmm.
Different kinds of pulp, both abaca and linen and cotton, and they all puckered different ways. And that drawing was so exciting to make on that scale and so beautiful to me, like, and thrilling in so many ways because it was like big without gravity and I kind of introduced color in a different way. And it just kind of launched a new direction in my work that I've been working on since.
Yes. And these drawings are amazing and they're not like drawings with a pencil or a tool.
Right.
And the fact that you're creating, I mean, most of them are 8 or 10 feet, 6 feet at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. from smaller sheets, correct?
Yes.
So these are not one full sheet of paper. These are pieced together and the pulp is manipulated in different ways. And we'll link to your work in the show notes.
Great.
And I did get to see that installation, which was fantastic to walk through. And I want to talk a little bit about how you reuse your work, and you show your installations in different spaces, and you have to reconfigure them, and just kind of how these things come about.
Sure. So often in the past, when I had made installations, I usually had a venue to start that it was going for, and I made it for that place. But this wasn't the case here. In this case, I just was so taken with that environment that I just sort of tried to recreate it in my studio, mm-hmm. and then had no clue, honestly, what I was going to do with it. And then Midori Yoshimoto, who's the curator at New Jersey City University Gallery, brought a group of students from a women in art class she was teaching to my studio. And she saw it and she thought, oh, this would look great in one of our gallery spaces. So I expanded the piece with that drawing I talked about. And then while we were, planning to do that, somebody got in touch with me coincidentally from an environmental art center called the Schuylkill Center outside of Philadelphia. And they were interested in having me make a piece. And I thought, well, I have this piece,
right?
Maybe we can make it go from one place to the next. And then Midori had another contact at Duke University at a place called the Center for Documentary Studies, and they were interested in the idea of art, how artists think about what makes a documentary. So it was kind of interesting set of places to show the piece in Jersey City, very close to the Hackensack River where it was conceived, and then to show it in an environmental center because it had environmental aspects to the work, and then to get to show it at a place that was thinking about what a documentary is was really exciting.
Yeah.
To have it go to those places. And then in the end, it also ended up going, the last venue was to Urban Glass in Brooklyn, which was interesting because there was glass in the piece, and that was a site where art gets made. So it was a little bit of a coincidence and a little bit of a, not a coincidence exactly, it was quite a headache to figure out how to move that piece from one place to the next without the kind of budget that a traveling show would have. But it was really great after all that work to mm-hmm. get to do it again and again. But I did have to rethink it each time. Mm-hmm. And when the piece was moving to the Schuylkill Center outside of Philadelphia, the gallery floor was a hardwood parquet floor, and they weren't going to let me pour blue pulp all over it, and it wouldn't have looked very good anyway. So I experimented in the studio with different materials to cover the floor and hit upon tar paper, the roofing stuff, which I covered the floor with, poured the pulp. It held the pulp beautifully, but it actually did change the piece more than it changed in any other site because the dark ground sort of totally transformed the experience of the piece. So, it was something new. And I guess the thing about that is that each time it moves, it's something new. And I learn new things. It expands in different ways, opens up new possibilities. So it, something stays the same and something changes.
Right. And with that tar paper, so were you able to create that in your studio as opposed to, did it save you time?
No, not at all. Because it wouldn't have rolled and everything the same way. And it's kind of made in response to the installation too. So I covered the whole floor, put the piece on the floor, and mm-hmm. then poured the pulp in response to how everything went. So all of the elements are a little bit different each time, depending on where you can hang from the ceiling, where the joists are, all that kind of stuff. So, no, it didn't save any time.
Well, your installations are amazing, and it's really interesting to hear about all the different ways that you have used paper. You've really tried all sorts of things with it. And I think you have a show now. When the podcast comes out, it might not be up anymore, but we'll certainly post links, a gallery show with some of your paper drawings we were talking about.
Right. So the show is, well, it just closed. It's at Catherine Markell Gallery on 20th Street in Chelsea. And it's a show of handmade paper drawings that were made in response to two residencies I did last summer. One where I spent 2 weeks on a sailboat in Samana, the Dominican Republic, with an organization called Ninth Wave Global, sort of studying the ecology of the area, not making art, but learning and absorbing. And then a month residency at Studio Works at the Tides Institute in Eastport, Maine, kind of responding to the extraordinary landscape out there at the easternmost tip of Maine with amazing tides. So although the work that preceded it was really large, like 10, 11 feet tall, the pieces that are in this show are more in the 4 or 5 foot range because I needed to be able to move the work easily in the car. So I'm now working on both scales, kind of squares that are 4 feet more or less, and then still really large vertical and horizontal pieces.
Right. And I wanted to ask you, you work in the studio all the time. You say you work all the time. And when you have a show like this show, did you plan the works for the show or do you sometimes pick other pieces?
What happened with that was I made the work. You know, I started the work over the summer in these places and was excited about it. So showed it to Kathy Markell, a gallery that I'd shown in once before, just, you know, just for her to see it. And then she said, oh, I love this. Let's do a show. And the work was ongoing. So I ended up probably having maybe 12 pieces, of which six or seven were going to fit in the gallery. So it's not the whole body of work. So it wasn't made specifically for that. But the other interesting thing that happened is when I was photographing the work to get ready for the show, I was moving it around the studio and noticed some unexpected connections between that work that was very consciously made in relationship to Maine and the Dominican Republic with sculptures that were part of an ongoing series. And I couldn't believe how closely connected they were, even when they weren't made with the same obvious thought process. So I showed Kathy some pictures of how these things got paired and accidentally in the studio. And I said, maybe we should do that. Mm-hmm. And she said, go ahead. So in the end, the show is drawings that were all made in one time period and then sculptures that strongly connect and have a lot of conversation, but were made over a longer time period. So that's been interesting.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. And I want to talk a little bit about making small sheets of paper in your studio. I know your son recently got married and you had emailed me several months ago, maybe a year ago, about making paper for wedding invitations production, because that's not something you usually right. do. Tell me about that project.
Okay, so my son just got married a few weeks ago and I was sort of surprised, but he and his now wife said, oh, we'd like to make the wedding invitations. We'd like to make handmade paper wedding invitations with you. And honestly, I thought of you right away, Helen, because when I first met you, you were making wedding invitations for your wedding. And they were like so beautifully constructed and so exacting. And, you know, they folded up. Did they fold up into like the mailer or something?
Yeah, they were a mailer with a postcard that tore yeah. off. I'm yeah, all about economy. And yes, but I had Dudonet paper mail.
Right, you had the space and we were going to be doing this in my studio. And then as I was talking to them, it turned out that they were perfectly happy if every invitation turned out a little bit different. So yeah, we did. I had several small molds and a friend of mine was just closing her paper studio where she had a whole bunch of molds. So I had a whole bunch of hers. And lots of leftover pulp from earlier projects. And basically, they made the invitations. I just was sort of the studio assistant making, you know, blending up all the pulp in my blender. And so it was a ton of work to prepare that much pulp without like a big facility. And then it was a ton of work to dry hundreds of pieces of paper without a press or, you know, drying facilities. But it worked out fine. I sort of did a lot of changing of sheets and towels and cardboard and, you know, like did my best to kind of mimic what was going on. So it was great. And my son had grown up around Dudenay, especially when he was little, he used to spend time there and took a class there and, you know, like was very connected to the place. So it was sweet that he then wanted his wedding invitations made out of paper. So it was a joint effort and it was really fun.
Yeah. And how did you print those?
After they dried, I got some rubber stamps made by a guy in the East Village. And we printed with silver ink on various shades of blue paper. It was beautiful. We made lots of mistakes. You know, some of the printing was backwards and, you know, all kinds of things happened, but we ended up with plenty and each one was different because they had sort of some pulp painting. We had this little system. I would blend the pulp. My son would make the paper and his girlfriend would sort of flick different colors of pulp onto the paper. So each one had a different tone and different, you know, decorative elements, and they were really nice and each one unique. It was really fun.
Oh, cool. Guerrilla paper making. Yeah. All right. And what are you up to next in the studio?
Well, the next thing I'm doing is moving my studio, which is quite an ordeal this week, and unpacking when I get there. But an installation that I made a number of years ago for a show in Holland, which was a challenging and interesting project because I had been at that point making all of my installations by draping wet abaca paper over a hard wire armature and having the paper shrink around the armature, kind of like a drum. So that had been my method. Mm-hmm. And I made this enormous 60-foot-long piece for this museum in South Jersey. This show in Holland was interested in the piece, but then the shipping was prohibitive for them. So I had to kind of rethink it. And I ended up making a new piece where I put the wire, instead of a hard wire armature that the paper was draped around, I put flexible wire, thick kind of plastic coated electrical wire inside the paper so that the paper itself could bend. And so that was kind of a new innovation in order to make a piece I could ship. And that's basically been in boxes ever since. And I'm putting it up next week at a new gallery called Biobat in Brooklyn, which is based on the idea of collaboration of work about the intersection of art and science. So some work collaborations with scientists and some work using information from scientists. And my piece is based on a river and on an ecological study of the river and the ecosystem around there. So it fits the framework of the show.
Right. And I want to mention that where you exhibited was the Holland Paper Biennial, which is happens in Holland every 2 years, and it's a great opportunity for paper artists.
It was fun because besides just the, you know, exciting thing about showing in a big, beautiful museum, you meet artists from all over the world, and everybody, especially that was installing a big piece, and there were a bunch of us, were there together, and they put us up in, you know, a place, and so it was like a very collegial, friendly environment with everybody working really hard, but like having meals together and stuff. It was nice.
Oh, yeah. Neat. Well, Nancy, it's been a real treat catching up with you, and I want to make sure people know how to see your work online. So how do they do that?
My website is nancymmarycohen.com. Cool.
And we'll post some links to things we've talked about in the show notes. So it's been fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. Nice to talk to you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon. The reason, besides the season.